made to Moses, the people of Israel. And then he goes, and verse 2, and Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, do you see that there? That, chapter 29, verses 1 and 2, is the beginning of the third and final sermon included in this book. So what we have just heard tonight is the conclusion of the second sermon. So Moses preaches this epic and encyclopedic sermon and finishes it on that note. This picture of a man, a male and a female Israelite standing in utter weakness and powerlessness in a slave market in Egypt, and nobody is bidding. That's the picture that he leaves them with. That's the prospect he puts before them, which is a sobering note, I think we'll all agree, to finish a sermon on. But there is a third sermon. There is a third sermon. So what are we to make of all of these things? How are we to approach all of this? Well, let me start by saying this, just kind of stepping aside for a moment. Back in 1900, pearl fishermen off the coast of Sicily were diving, and they came across the wreck of a ship called the Antikythera. And the Antikythera ship had gone down with all its goods on board, and they were treasure seekers, and so they began to bring things up. And in amongst the things they found the Antikythera mechanism, which is a series of brass cogs and wheels that all fitted and worked together. It's estimated to have been made in 150 BC. And it is the world's first analog computer. It was designed to work in such a way as to make astronomical predictions so that people could use these different gears and wheels and their knowledge of the workings of the universe to predict eclipses, for example, which were seen as bad omens. So, for example, if you're having a coronation for a king, you wanted to make sure that it wasn't going to fall at the same time as an eclipse. So this machine computed these times and hours and for festivals and the like. It wasn't, by modern standards, terribly accurate, but Archimedes, the Greek mathematician, was behind this project. He was building on a body of knowledge from the Babylonian times of people trying to look into the future, to predict the future, to accurately determine what is discerned for the coming days. And what we have before us here tonight, this passage we have before us tonight, both from verses 1 onwards with the blessings and the cursing together, is something obviously far older than that, far more accurate than that, and far more important than those attempts at kind of staving off superstition. What we have here is a document which predicts the consequences of obedience and disobedience to the covenant. And it does so, and it supplies it to the people of God as a prophetic tool. And by that I mean this: if you do this, this will happen. This is a compass. This is a mechanism by which the people of God can look into the future and say, if we live like this, this is what life will look like in the future. So that vision of this, the naked man and woman standing in the slave market, is a potential place where they could end up. But they're not victims. Their obedience, what they do, how they live, will have a determining effect on where they end up. So did you notice, perhaps, at the beginning, in chapter 28, perhaps if you look at chapter 28, verse 3, and look at the blessings there, how one of the first things that are mentioned, blessed in the city, blessed in the field, did you notice that? And then as you go forward into the curses, which we've just been reading in verse 16, cursed you shall be in the city, cursed you shall be in the field. Can you see that they're like inversions of each other? So the same subject matter, the city and the field, are in view. What's it going to be like living in one of our cities in the future? What's it going to be like going for a walk in the countryside and the fields in the future? It's going to be one of two things, ultimately. It depends on the direction of travel. It depends how you live your life. Whether literally our cities are going to be like a nightmare walking through the cities, a place of fear and trembling, or are they going to be places of peace and prosperity, and learning and knowledge and the love of God? That's the kind of the possibilities that are being put out before here. All the things that are describing here, there's nothing here that's not natural. Do you see? All these things are natural things, aren't they? The bread basket, animals having their children, the relationships between different nations, all perfectly natural things. But I don't think you could have missed, as we were reading through this, that these natural things, God is sovereignly directing them for a particular purpose. He's harnessing the world that he's made, these ordinary things, the ordinary processes of life. You know, you put cattle together, they have their offspring. It's just the ordinary processes of life. But under God's hand, as he applies it in these situations, he either adds to that ordinary process a blessing which causes incredible prosperity, or he can add his curse which brings misery beyond measure. But he's doing it. He's behind this. He's active in this situation. Why? Why in the curses? Why are these curses? What's the function? What's the purpose of it? What's the function of the blessings? Surely the blessings are a reward for obedience. And the curses are a punishment for disobedience. But it's not just simply the satisfaction of his own soul to reward or to punish. Every warning, every one of these curses is a warning, isn't it? It's a call from God to repent, isn't it? Yes? To turn back, to change direction, to change course. Did you notice as we're reading through it how often Egypt was mentioned? Did you notice that? And Moses was in Egypt. Right? He's not talking in abstract terms. He was there. He stood there before Pharaoh and he said, "Let my people go." He told Egypt exactly what Egypt had to do for blessing. And he warned them what would come in terms of cursing if they disobeyed. What happened in Egypt is Egypt disobeyed, and bit by bit, the first curses were, you know, the river turned to blood. Nobody got hurt, right? Warnings. And then the curses, as you see, if you go through the 10 curses that are recorded there, bit by bit, the blows fall heavier and closer and more intense until eventually they lose their firstborn children. And it's like that Moses has seen what it is to warn a people about the impending judgments and to see people harden their hearts and see the curses of Almighty God destroy a nation. He saw it with his own eyes. He's not making this up. It's from his own experience. And now he's talking to Israel now. He's not standing before the Pharaoh. He's talking about to God's people and said, "Do you know, if you do the same thing will happen to you." You know, nobody's immune. Nobody's got a special license. Trust and obey. Trust and obey. There is no other way. So, but there is a difference. I want to highlight something here because this is really important. I mean, this is such a big subject, this. How can you tell the difference between ordinary calamity, if I can put it like that, ordinary misfortunes which befall all men, which you cannot say this is because of some terrible sin that person has committed. You know, Jesus was saying, was when the wall fell on the people in Jerusalem, was it because of that? You know, there are things that just happen to people. What is the difference between that and the kind of miseries that are spoken about here? I said this is a prophetic tool. And just like Egypt, the things it suffered in Egypt, what went before the signs was the word. the prophet rose up and spoke the word, and the signs followed the word. Yes? And that's how you can tell whether this is when these calamities befall a nation or a people or whatever it might be. It's because before they happen, the prophet arises full of the Spirit and says, this is exactly what's going to happen, makes that prediction, and then the signs follow. And we should assume that when it's just happening widely and generally in the world, we shouldn't try to read providence and say, oh, because this has happened to this people and this, we shouldn't just assume X, Y, and Z about their walk with God. But when the prophet has arisen and spoken the word, and then it comes to pass, then we should all be paying very careful attention to what is happening. Signs, signs that follow the word. So I think the big difference between this kind of calamity in the world and in this circumstance is whether they've been prophetically announced. Yeah? Is that point clear? So it's a prophetic tool. So imagine a sliding scale. Yes, a sliding scale. And at one end of the sliding scale, we have extreme blessings. The other end of the sliding scale, extreme curses. And underneath extreme blessings is total obedience. And underneath total cursings, absolute cursings, is complete disobedience at the other end. And the way this scale functions, the way this works with this inversion of things, cursing at one end and disobedience, blessings and obedience at the other end, is that you are supposed to put your marker down and say, where do I stand on this line? Where am I? How is my walk with God today? Am I walking in obedience today? Can I put my marker down there under obedience, or am I really in truth in disobedience? Am I sort of wavering somewhere? Where do I stand with the Lord? And having done that exercise, perhaps look at your community and say, well, how are we faring? What measure of degree of obedience is manifest amongst us? Or in truth, are we cold-hearted and grumbling? Or, you know, where do we stand? What's happening in our nation? You know, to make an assessment. What's the pulse? What's the condition? What's the spiritual temperature of our nation today? How obedient is this nation? And if you're able to look beyond to the world and say, looking at the world today, where, if I'm being honest, does this mark belong? Where does this marker belong? And if you are being helped to see where those markers belong, then you can calculate the measure of blessing or cursing that will result from those, that attitude of heart that is existing now. Can you see that? And this is the method that the prophets use. This is how the prophets look into the future. What is the benchmark of obedience? It's not just random obedience. Obedience to what? To God's declared will. To the law in this case. Obedience to the law. So they're not victims. They are in the driving seat. There's the law. Do it, and these will be the outcomes. And the signs will follow. You can trust and rely on God. This will work every time. So can you see, it's like a complex computer algorithm where you input the data of the spiritual climate and it gives you a prediction of what the world, the conditions of life will be as a result for you, for your family, for your community, for your nation, for the world. And the person who understands the law, the word of God, understands themselves, understands their community and their country, understands the world in which they live, that person can use this mechanism to make a prediction about where are we traveling? Where are we going with all of these things? So, what do you call a person like that? You call them a prophet. What they're doing, they're making prophecies. They're looking at the world, they're looking at themselves and saying, here we are, where are we going to be? and playing with this machine until they fine-tuned it, they can understand. They can understand and make accurate predictions. What do you find in the scriptures? What do the prophets do in the scriptures time and time and time again? They make hard, fast, accurate predictions about what's going to happen, even sometimes down to the names of people and where they're going to come from. Remarkable accuracy. So the prophets, when they're writing the whole Old Testament and into the New Testament as well, as the Bible is being written, have you noticed the way they write up history? They make a point of showing how this event is a direct consequence of things that have happened in the past. Because you did not walk in the way of so on and so forth. They're linking it always to the obedience and disobedience of God's people. And that's how they write it. They don't write everything that happens in the whole history of Israel and the world, or what they ate for breakfast every day. They want to see people's interaction with the covenant and see how God is showing himself faithful to his word, blessings and cursings. How God is working in the world. So specifically, this is Israel, isn't it? Specifically, it's Israel. You can look all the way through the scriptures and see this record of Israel's covenant history. And when I'm talking about Israel's covenant history, some people think, oh, we're talking about the Old Testament here. But the New Testament is Israel's covenant history too, isn't it? So the whole Bible, and in the New Testament, you have prophecies. You see prophecies being made in the New Testament. And some of those prophecies, it's all hinging around this same paradigm, the same process. Some of the prophecies of the New Testament concern very immediate matters. Jesus on the Mount of Olives saying, this generation will not pass away until all these things have come to pass. Talking about the destruction of the temple. And within that generation, the temple, which everybody thought would last forever, was in ruins. Prophecy, prediction, and fulfillment in a generation. Some of the things that you see in scriptures, the view goes beyond the course of that period, going into, maybe Romans chapter 11 or something like that, and all Israel shall be saved. Looking far into the future, the book of Revelations. But it's all hinging on the same process. God makes these judgments. He makes his assessments about how people are living, and there are direct consequences for those things worked out in the world. So, for example, when you see in 1 Kings, let's look just one or two examples. 1 Kings chapter 22-23, one of those kind of always interesting passages where Micaiah the prophet, who most people don't sort of... Chapter 22, verse 23, 1 Kings, just as an interesting example. Micaiah the prophet, here's somebody, the king has been walking in disobedience. He wants to have a prophet come up and make a prediction about whether his battle is going to go well or not. Everybody knows this guy doesn't listen to the word of the Lord at all. He's walking in disobedience. And so Micaiah tells him everything's going to be fine. And then he gets furious with him. The king gets furious with Micaiah because, Micaiah, you always say everything's going to be fine. But I know really you don't think everybody's going to come. Tell me the truth. And then Micaiah tells him the truth. And the truth is that God has commissioned a lying spirit to come down and enter the mouth of the prophets and deceive the king so that he should go into battle, and in that battle he will die. How many times did you notice when we read through chapter 28 in those passages, say 28:28, and I will send confusion and madness? Do you see the prophet? It's the way they're writing up that episode. They're showing how this is a fulfillment of that. You walk in disobedience, he'll send you mad. He'll fill your head with nonsense. You'll believe it and you'll die. You'll perish. Chapter 28, looking at it in Deuteronomy again, for example, did you notice this? This is a really striking point and something we should be very, very sober about. Chapter 28, verse 47. Do you see that the great warning that is being given there, that in the midst of their prosperity, do you see how this is the great warning, isn't it? That while they're prosperous, the danger, they've got everything going for them, they're rich and secure, that in the midst of that, sounds like Jesus' parable, doesn't it? You know, the deceitfulness of riches. You're in the middle of that sort of situation of life. And then the judgments fall upon you all the more heavily because you have not taken advantage of the peace and the opportunities and the prosperity that God has given you. And then you read something like Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 7. I'll find it and read it to you. Jeremiah chapter 2 and verse 7. And I brought you into a plentiful land, says Jeremiah, to enjoy its fruits and its good things. But when you came in, you defiled my land and made my heritage an abomination. Can you see? It's the same thing. I brought you into the land. I gave you all. What have you done with it? What have you done with it? Judgment. That's what Jeremiah is coming to bring, isn't he? Telling them there will be a judgment. Now, I know that basically all of this thing deals primarily with Israel, but we shouldn't forget that everything in 28 is based on God's dealings, not with Israel, but with Egypt, with another nation, another people, and how God dealt with them. So we should be looking at this and say, of course, this could affect our nation. This is relevant to our nation, our world today. I can think of a good example of that. Go to Romans with me, if you will. I'm not going to dart around too much tonight. Romans chapter 11, and one of the most sobering verses, when you think about what happened to Israel, when you think about the destruction of the temple and the annihilation and all the things that Israel has suffered, it says in chapter 11, verse 21, speaking to the nations, if God did not spare the natural branches, Israel, neither will he spare you. What makes you think as a nation that you can escape if he wouldn't even let his beloved Israel off the hook, right? It's quite serious, isn't it? That's how God dealt with Israel. What nation has an excuse? Now, please be careful when you listen to modern day prophets, inverted commas. Okay, there's people saying, thus saith the Lord, and all the rest of it. Be very careful, okay, how you hear and what you hear. But don't think for a minute that our nation is immune. All right? That would be folly. That would be folly to think we're immune. So, when you see nations in decline, when you see health in decline, when you see wealth in decline, standing and respect of nations or peoples or churches or whatever in decline, when you see peace fleeing, when you see these things, what should we do, brothers and sisters? What should we do based on these things? What should we do? Seek the Lord. Shouldn't we? In other words, what are we doing, Lord? What are we doing that we shouldn't be doing? What are we not doing that we should be doing? Teach us. Put us in the way of obedience. Turn back the tide. And trying to change course. Change course. Because there is hope in this passage too, isn't there? There is hope. We've read one of two parts. There's blessings and cursings. Obedience and disobedience. There is hope. But here's the thing. I've heard, it's so common, isn't it? People want God's blessing and they say, I'm going to do this and I want to live like that and I want you to bless me. What's very clear from this is that the way to blessing is not asking him to bless us in the things we want to do. It's finding out what does he want us to do and doing it. Okay, last thing. Something not said in this passage. There's something that's not said in this passage, and it's quite important. I know you can always, it's dangerous, isn't it, to argue from silence. But I think there's something that we do need to say. There's a lot about perishing and destruction in these passages. But I think there's one glaring and deliberate omission. Do you notice that bit about being left as just a few people? Yeah, all that prosperity reduced until you're just a few people. Despite the severity, these judgments are intense, aren't they? But nowhere, at any time, do you ever read God declaring, and I will sever my covenant with you. Did you hear that? Did he ever say, and I will leave you, and I will forsake you, you will not be my people, and I will not be your God. Did you hear that? It's not there. It's not there. So Here are people walking in disobedience up to the very, very edge of the world, into the darkest corners of the world. But even there, he doesn't say, I will now dissolve my covenant with you. He doesn't say it. All that chastisement, chastisement after chastisement, discipline after discipline, God never walks away. He remains. He remains because they are still his people. That's quite something to think about, isn't it? That is still something to think about. Look at verse 63, which is the end, this closing moment in the sermon, this extraordinary sermon, this picture. Moses has seen people brought into the slave markets. When he was a prince, he would have seen this scene. This is a familiar scene. The Israelites had heard from their parents about probably themselves being bought and sold in the slave markets just like this, where he finishes up his great sermon. And there, in the slave market, they who started in Egypt and have been brought out of Egypt and traveled through the wilderness and come to the land and conquered the land have ended up full circle, ending up exactly where everything started. Back to the beginning. Snakes and ladders. Don't you hate that last snake at the end of the game on 99? You hit it and boom, you're back to the bottom line. Back where they started. And there they are in the slave market. And what's it finished? And there will be no buyer. Yes, there'll be no buyer. There's this silence, isn't there? And there they are, beaten, discouraged, guilty, miserable, abandoned, lonely, weak, powerless. And nobody wants to they are totally toxic. Nobody wants to touch them, right? They're just too filthy, too dirty, too much baggage. Nobody will touch them. Who will buy them? Who will... Do you know there's a Hebrew word? Goel. Goel. Right? And Goel is translated redeemer. The person who will buy somebody back. Who will buy them? They're worthless. Right? They've got no value at all. Who's going to buy this rubbish, this schlock? Right? Another bit of Yiddish. You had some this morning. Have some this evening. Who will buy them? Is there a redeemer? Will anybody buy these people? Because whoever buys them is going to have to start from Egypt again and take them back through Egypt, back through the wilderness, back through into the land again, reestablish them back in the place where they were in the former place and bring them back into obedience and blessings and take them the whole way. And they're worthless. And they're going to have to spend themselves and spend themselves and spend themselves to achieve it. Will there be such a person who will do a rerun? The Exodus from Egypt, Mark 2. The sequel. And how did they come out first time round? What happened? Signs and wonders, plagues and boils and darkness. And the same signs and wonders have brought Israel back to Egypt. The same boils, you kept reading about the boils in there, the same boils that were in Egypt have come on there. They're covered in the same boils. They've been brought back by the same boils that brought them out. Will God also now give those boils to their enemies and set them free again? Will he turn his face to shine upon them? Will he show them mercy? Will he show them grace? Is there a redeemer? Who will save? Who will save? Miserable, broken sinners. That is the question at the end of this. And I think this is it. Underneath this covenant of works of do and live, do and live, do and live. These are the consequences. These are the consequences of your actions. There's another covenant at work. A glorious covenant at work. Not a covenant of works of do and live. A covenant of grace. It says live and do. And here we see there's this kind of hiatus at the end there. They are all on their own. Will at this moment, this covenant of mercy and grace kick in, sweep them up in the arms of a merciful God and take them again as his people and bring them back and restore them to their former place? There's hope, isn't there? There's hope for a chastised and miserable sinner in that moment to cry to the Lord and be saved, isn't there? And as you look through the passage here, when he talks about them, verse 62, whereas you were as numerous as the heavens, you shall be left few in number. There's a word for that that gets used again and again through the whole narrative of the scriptures. Remnant, survivors, people who come through, even these terrible times. Whether our disobedience, the consequences of our disobedience have been visited upon us, but nevertheless, out through that emerge survivors, a remnant. And you can look through Israel's history and find it, and again, when Joseph was betrayed by his very own flesh and blood, by his brothers. And yet it's recorded in chapter 47, verse 7, at the other end of that experience, Joseph says to them, God sent me before you to preserve you a remnant of the earth. Did they deserve it? But did God give it? Because the covenant of grace is at work. Judah, when it went into captivity in Babylon, 2 Kings chapter 19, verse 30, and the surviving remnant of the house of Judah shall again take root downward and bear fruit upwards. For out of Jerusalem shall go a remnant, and out of Mount Zion a band of survivors. The zeal of the Lord will do this, not because of their obedience, because he is zealous for his people. The love of God. Ezra, again, he takes up the same theme, chapter 9, verse 8. But now, for a brief moment, favor has been shown by the Lord. Favor. That's what it is, just favor. By the Lord our God, to leave us a remnant, give us a secure foothold in this holy place, that our God may brighten our eyes, grant us a little reviving in our slavery. We are slaves, yet our God has not forsaken us, even in our slavery, has extended his steadfast love to us. You can find that all through the prophets. Okay, you can find this story repeated again and again. No explanation. It's not a consequence of action or inaction. It's grace. Peter talks about it when he's speaking in Acts chapter 15, verse 17, that the remnant of mankind might seek the Lord, that throughout the nations there might be people from all the nations who be gathered, that they might know God. And famously, of course, in Romans, Paul says, chapter 11, verse 5, so too at this present time. Now, bear in mind, this is after Christ had been crucified. That's as disobedient as it gets. He says, at this present time, there is a remnant chosen by grace. And if it is by grace, it is no longer on the basis of works. Otherwise, grace would not be grace. It's grace. His grace. Somebody said, if you're trying to find the book of Lamentations in the Bible, just find the wet pages. Have you found them? Have you ever read the book? Find the damp pages. Lamentations. Turn with me to Lamentations. We're nearly finished. If you don't know where it is, it's after Jeremiah. If you don't know where Jeremiah is, I'm sorry. Somewhere in the middle. Book of Lamentations is a record of how the covenant curse fell on Jerusalem and all its people. It is a record of unspeakable human suffering and misery. That's why it's called Lamentations. Unspeakable suffering and misery. Because, as Jeremiah knows all too well, as one who's been well attuned to how this whole mechanism works. He's been talking about this destruction for a long time, calling people to obey for a long time. They've not listened for a long time, and now it's happened. And he's caught up in the midst of it, and there's just a remnant left alive. Just a remnant left alive. In short, this is hell on earth. Okay? This is as close to hell as you get on earth. And the only distinction between hell on earth and hell is that even when there's hell on earth, there's still hope. Here in chapter 3, in the midst of all this misery, just cast your eyes down the verses as you work your way through the first chapter, the second chapter, the anger of the Lord, the day of ruins, the cry of the mothers, where is bread? Arise, cry in the night. Chapter 3, verse 8, I'm a man who's seen affliction under the rod of his wrath. He knows where this suffering has come from. He's broken my bones, verse 4. He's walled me in. I can't escape, verse 7. He is a bear, talking about God, lying in wait for me, a lion in hiding. He's bent his bow, verse 12, and set me as a target for his arrows. He's filled me with bitterness and sated me with wormwood, verse 15. He's made my teeth grind on gravel, made me cower in the ashes. This is Jeremiah the prophet, right? He's been caught up in the disobedience of all these other people. It's all conspired together and he's caught up in it. But look in verse 18. So I say, my endurance has perished. So is my hope in the Lord. Remembering my affliction and my wandering to wormwood and the gall, my soul continually remembers and is bowed down within me. Then verse 21. But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. You know the song? Here's the verse. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I will hope in him. It's remarkable, isn't it? In the worst, darkest moment, there's this hope. And as we see, the blessings in chapter 28 of Deuteronomy give us some glimmer of what heaven will be like. So these curses give us a glimmer of what hell will be like. But the difference is that this heaven on earth, there's always the peril and the danger of falling. And this hell on earth always puts forward the possibility of hope and change. But heaven and hell, once they're settled, once the concrete is set on our souls and we are fixed in one or the other, that is over. Who is the guarantor of this hope? Why is there hope? Even despite the fact that these people are fully responsible for everything they've done, why is there still hope? Why is God so merciful? Because there is a redeemer. Because out of the crowd, as the naked slaves stand there, valueless, somebody steps forward and said, I will pay. I will buy them. And the price is that the curse that is upon them should be taken and visited upon him. The kind of suffering and the misery we're talking about, this passage, chapter 28, is one of the unique opportunities, Lamentations, to see the suffering of Christ's soul. If you want to understand something of the suffering of Christ's soul on the cross, Deuteronomy 28, the book of Lamentations. The curse upon himself, that the full measure of the curse should not fall upon us for our disobedience, but the window of grace might remain open, always open. While there is life, there is hope, because Christ has purchased that hope. The light shines in the darkness. And that's what's being unsaid at the end of chapter 28 and verse 63 there. And it doesn't tell us who the Redeemer is at the end. Moses doesn't tell us his name, but we can say it. We know who he is. We know it's Jesus. Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus Christ. He is the Redeemer. Christ crucified. So, to conclude, doesn't matter how bad we get, and I'm not encouraging anybody on the road of disobedience. Doesn't matter how bad the church gets, or our country gets, or the world gets, there is hope in Christ, isn't there? There's hope in Jesus Christ. And you have a more sure word of prophecy than even this mechanism, which we may or may not be able to properly understand and work. And you have a more sure word of prophecy, and this is it. That even if the world ends in flames, he will remake it. That even if you die, you will live again. You have hope because of Jesus Christ. No matter what situation. So when people are crying, oh, it's all... You have hope to offer this world. Real hope to offer the world in the person of Jesus Christ. Because it's written, isn't it? Romans. Who can separate us from the love of God? And go home and read that passage, chapter 8 of Romans. If you want to do your soul good, go home and read Romans chapter 8. Who can separate us from the love of God through Jesus Christ? Because the power of the cross is greater than the worst power of the deepest, darkest sin. We have a Redeemer. We have a Redeemer. I think we're going to sing. Great, we could sing Great is Thy Faithfulness, couldn't we? But 673, Jesus.